You're not going to admit that for the first time in your life, you committed a purely human, emotional act?
No, sir.
Mr. Spock, you're a stubborn man.
Yes, sir.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton reporting for duty. Cam, what's the conundrum this week?
Well, this week's special conundrum is exploring Star Trek's outsider characters.
So when we talk about outsiders, and I may accidentally say another word, like others, you know, by accident.
I thought it was going to be like a derogatory term.
No, I'm not like that, Cameron. But we're talking about, you know, those characters. Look, they're easy to identify. Let's just get them out. It's not going to be a surprise for any of the listeners. But we're talking about people like Spock, Data, mm-hmm. Seven of Nine, T'Pol, you know, Odo, you know,
right.
Those characters. The ones that are very much on the outside looking into humanity, essentially. And these are the characters that we always think of. Like, it's almost a journey to better understand humanity to varying degrees. So there's other characters, like alien characters on Star Trek, that I wouldn't necessarily classify as these same sorts of archetypical kinds of outsider characters.
Right, like you could say like Worf is an outsider because he's a Klingon among humans on the Enterprise, but I think what's important about Worf in comparison to some of these other characters that we're going to talk about is that Worf is someone who never really struggles with his Klingon heritage very much.
He embraces his Klingon.
He embraces it, and the people around him embrace him for it and recognize it and respect it. Whereas these characters are a little more like insecure maybe about their status among the crew and are often put in positions of having to maybe consider trying to change their perspectives or feeling just like they kind of don't belong.
But they have a lot of internal conflict.
Yes.
That's sparks from the humanity that's almost within them to a certain degree. And there's some exceptions to that, and we can go into that as we move through these characters, because I think one in particular that we're going to delve into, I'm not so sure if that character is necessarily in the same category as these, but it's going to be fascinating to get into it. So, Cam, why don't we start with the first one? Let's start big. Let's start with one of the fan favorites out there. But
Neelix.
Yes. Neelix. Okay. All our listeners have dropped off at this point. Anyway, Seven of Nine. We're still on Voyager. So
right.
Seven of Nine, she drops in Episode 1, Season 4, Scorpion Part 2. And I think that it's an important case. You and I were going back and forth as we were preparing for this episode that are we going to tackle the Doctor here? And I made an argument, and I think you and I are on the same page here, that I think the Doctor was the prototypical, you know, outsider character for up until the point that he received the mobile emitter. Mm-hmm. He was not, you know, trapped in sick bay anymore. And Seven of Nine made her appearance just a few episodes later, and she pretty much took that mantle away from the Doctor. Do you have thoughts there?
It's very obvious to me that the Doctor was supposed to be Data.
Yes.
From day one. Like, that's what that character was there to be. And, you know, they got some good material out of it by matching him with Kes. You know, we got to see the Doctor, you know, wanting to have a name, wanting to be respected as a human among the crew, having to, you know, the same rights, which, you know, kind of led to stuff similar to like Measure of a Man with Data, having his, you know, role on the ship always being kind of under question, because what do we take this guy as? Is he, you know, a person or is he a machinery? So there was definitely those threads there, but I think one of the smartest things they ever did with the Doctor is that, as we'll get into with Seven of Nine, is that they did something finally with him that we had never seen before. Like, a lot of what the Doctor went through in the first few seasons was kind of like Data 2.0.
Yeah.
But not quite as good. Kind of like Voyager was TNG 2.0. But once Seven of Nine comes on, I think the Doctor becomes far more interesting and takes on a mantle that no other character we're going to talk about in the show or in this particular podcast episode ever did, which is we get to watch him become a mentor to Seven of Nine, teaching her about humanity, which I think was fascinating and the best thing that ever could have happened to that character. And it does kind of remove him from this sort of category of what we're going to talk about today, because he really becomes the champion of humanity to a certain point.
A lot of people might be fearful that, you know, you bring in a character like Seven of Nine and she's going to supplant the Doctor as a character, a very prominent character on the show. But it's interesting how they bounced off each other so much. Mm-hmm. And I think the Doctor benefited a lot from the introduction of Seven of Nine. And I think he kind of spelled out exactly why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as much as I wanted more Beowulf stories, because we only really covered book one, you know,
yeah,
there's two more books.
Oh, Grendel.
And what, Grendel? We never got to see Grendel's mom.
I know.
The dragon.
Man.
What could have been?
Well, so let's bring it back to Seven of Nine, though. She's introduced, and we see her in her Borg self, you know, as a drone, and they slowly chip away, and by slowly, I mean she's in that cat suit by what, I think the gift? Or no, I think she's still Borgified by the gift when we say goodbye to Kes,
it's
but...
probably in, what, her third episode of the season?
I'd say probably her third episode, yeah, that she's in that silver cat suit, very iconic.
I think probably one more episode than the producers really wanted.
That's true. Yeah, and so she's already, like, making overtures to Harry Kim about exploring her sexuality, and he's like, whoa, no.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very clear that she's going about it in the same way Data did, where she just doesn't get it, you know, just like the nuances of humanity. And it's interesting to me that we have a lot of these characters going on in Star Trek, you know, say that your Datas or your Seven of Nines, who all those subtle things about humanity don't register with him. And this actually becomes like something that really picks up in television a lot lately, where you have characters in, say, a television show like Community, which you're a fan of, like Abed, as well as a show, The Bridge, which, not related to The Bridge from Star Trek, but this is an FX series about a bridge between Texas and Mexico. And anyways, what we're getting is these kind of characters that it's almost as if they have, and I'm not trying to use this term in any sort of disrespectful way, but a type of, like, maybe somewhere on the spectrum of, say, right, autism, where they don't quite get, you know, what's going on, but it provides them a chance to comment on what the other characters are doing, pointing out maybe some of the irony that's going on. And this is what Seven and I would say Data have very much in common.
Well, Seven, speaking of, you know, you're saying about, you know, this being on the spectrum, you know, we've been at conventions where fans have come up and told Jerry Ryan how much Seven meant to them, because it was like one of the first characters they'd ever seen on TV who was essentially reflecting back to them the experiences they were having. And that's something I don't think the producers really had that in mind in, you know, the year, what, 1997 or 8 or whatever it was when Seven of Nine came around. I don't think there's any way that was kind of in the... that sort of thinking wasn't in the zeitgeist.
I do recall that one particular individual who's talking about, like, to Jerry Ryan at a recent convention you and I were at, by recent, 6 months ago.
Sure.
He was telling her, you know, what a hero she was, and, you know, he was on the autism spectrum and all that. And then later on, during another panel, the moderator, I think, effectively told the kid to shut up, like, and it was very awkward, and I don't think the moderator understood that and by kid, I think he was, like, 16 or 17.
Right.
So it was like, oh, dear. Like, he poured
his
heart out.
Wasn't that the panel you moderated?
No. How dare you, Cameron. going back to, like, what we're talking about here, it's interesting that they don't quite get the nuances of humanity, and it's interesting that Star Trek was picking up on something that's become almost like a trope in modern television at this point. And I think, you know, it's great we have a character like Seven who, as much as she could fall into the same patterns as Data, I find her to be such a distinct character for all these different reasons.
Well, Seven of Nine is interesting because, you know, Data is an android who's trying to become human, whereas Seven of Nine was a human essentially turned into an android that is now finding her way back. So all of these experiences she once had, she's kind of trying to remember them or try and re-experience this or find it within herself what was lost. And she's almost kind of like a trauma victim who's having to kind of find a way to open up again. And a lot of the show, you know, Voyager is the most feminine of the Star Trek series, so I think it's a really interesting tack to take on this character. And it kind of makes sense to me why at the con last, in the Vegas con last summer, Kate Mulgrew was asked... actually by a friend of the show, Jar Hodge, about some of the female writers on Voyager and the ones, you know, she really liked. But Kate Mulgrew really made a point to emphasize how good Brennan Braga was at writing women. Like, she really highlighted him. And a lot of these episodes of Voyager really highlight his strengths in writing Seven of Nine stories, because he writes a lot of the really fantastic ones and taps in these stories that I don't think most writers, especially, you know, male writers in genre, were really doing at that time.
I do recall one of the ones that he highlighted from his own, you know, credits was, I believe, was that Human Nature, where she and Chakotay start experimenting with the holographic Chakotay, essentially, right. with when it comes to romance, which to me as a viewer really came out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But there you go. Robert Beltran, good looking hunk, so I don't blame her. But
he agrees with you.
yes he does. What do you think about the idea, though? Okay, so you have a character, it's easy to compare Data and Seven. We'll get into Data deeper further on, but Data is somebody who's striving to be human.
Right.
When Seven's introduced to the show, she is not striving to be human.
She
would rather go back into the collective.
And that struggle remains throughout. Like, she never is. Even by the end, she's not like, boy, I want to be human. I want to be human. It's really the Voyager crew trying to drag her to the finish line. And what I really like about that character is she's not, you know, a lot of these characters we're going to see are maybe being dragged towards the human side, maybe a little bit, you know, disrespectfully. You know, like, they maybe should be respected a little more in their own beliefs. Whereas Seven of Nine is someone who, it makes complete sense why they're trying to rehabilitate her.
Yeah.
And it's someone who's really going through a struggle that I don't think any of their characters we're going to talk about today do. And that makes her so much more sympathetic, and I think more of an emotional character to attach ourselves to than really any of the others.
Let's step backwards just a few weeks, maybe a month or two. You and I were discussing the evolution of the Borg, and we brought up how Dark Frontier, that's pretty much by the point that I just fully gave up on the Borg. Mm-hmm. This is the one where the Borg Queen comes back to Voyager, and she's trying to tempt Seven of Nine.
Yeah.
Do you think, as much as I think, you know, that the Borg lost me there, do you think that it's still an interesting dilemma for Seven of Nine that she has to deal with, you know? Or do you think, you know, as a main character on this show, a lot of the tension was kind of taken out of it because we knew deep down she would never choose the Borg over, say, Voyager.
Yeah, the whole idea of the Borg tempting her back never really works because I just never really got the vibe she was... The show never really sold that she was really being pulled that strongly in, because she was still fairly loyal to Janeway and a lot of the, you know, the crew. So... And that kicks in pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know, we don't ever feel like, you know, she's just going to kick the Doctor to the curb and go back to the Borg. Or that, you know, very sexy Chakotay.
Yes. Well, okay, so, you know, as we go through all these characters, Cam, why don't we do something fun where we kind of evaluate how far they go on the human adventure, you know? Seven of Nine, her grasp of humanity, by the end of the series, when we leave her off after four seasons of journeying with this character... Do you think she has a much stronger grasp of humanity than maybe some of the other characters we may be talking about later on? How would you rank her grasp of humanity, her journey overall, you know, as one of these outsider characters?
Well, what I like about Seven of Nine is something that can't really be said for a lot of these, which is there's a lot of ambiguity as to where her journey is going to take her at the end of the show. Star Trek doesn't typically end with a lot of ambiguity. And so I really like that because we've seen through the show that she's someone who keeps kind of almost like elastic, bouncing back, trying to pull herself forward. And she falls a lot throughout the show. And, you know, we get these moments of development like her with the Borg children, everyone's favorite storylines, or her relationship with Naomi Wildman, and how there's this sort of pulling her out of her shell, you know, becoming more of maybe a mother figure, more protective, feeling more of an emotional response to those around her. But even at the end, when that show ends, we don't get the sense like, well, you know what? Seven of Nine's going to go home, marry Chakotay, and live happily ever after. There's really that question of like, you know, is this going to last at all?
Well, what we see, though, and you kind of hit the nail on the head, is we see moments of her coming out of her shell. But like from episode to episode, she's very much kind of that kind of stone cold, you know, hard exterior throughout, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at her from, you know, episode 3 all the way to episode, you know, 26 of season 7, no pun intended, then you can definitely see, you know, she's a different kind of character. And I think a lot of that has to do with Jerry Ryan's willingness to, you know, make her go out of her shell more and more. But I think overall, she does not have this transformative sort of character arc.
No, it doesn't feel like, you know, she's fully recovered at the end.
Right.
Which, you know, I really give Voyager props. You know, we definitely kind of hold Voyager in sort of the lowest regard of the Star Trek series, I think. Would you agree?
Yeah, I'd agree.
But I do really admire that Braga and Berman, et cetera, chose to end her journey, and let's be honest, they were the most interested in her journey of anyone for those last few years, with a note of ambiguity, and, you know, the journey for her didn't feel finished.
Not that I'm a huge fan of fan fiction.
You want me to write some? Is this a pitch?
No, I want you to stop writing.
Oh, okay.
No, I would say that I think out of all the characters, you know, out there to further explore in like these non-canon sort of realms, I think right. 7 of 9 have at it. You know, there's so much left to explore. Whereas if you wanted to further explore the story arc of, say, Chief O'Brien.
I was going
to
say Captain Worf.
God. Captain Stiles. Yeah. I don't know if there's as much, ground to cover there. You know?
Right. Jeri Ryan made reference to saying she'd love to play 7 of 9 again. Most of the time when I hear Star Trek actors say that, I kind of cringe and die a little bit inside. When she said it, I was like, that would make sense. Like, I could see that character having more room to grow.
Knowing what a fan favorite Jeri Ryan is, and for anyone who's never seen her at a convention, she she turns the entire thousands of people in the audience into putty in her hands. Like, she's like a great person. She seems just so earnest and gracious and just like even lovelier than I could have ever imagined. But do you think she knows when she says something like, I'd love to play 7 of 9 again, that it's never going to happen? She doesn't ever have to worry about contracts or fitting into that cat suit ever again.
I think she knows.
Yeah. It's easy for her to say.
I think what she's saying more is that she really loves that character and understands, you know, how important it was to her career. And hey, she'd love to play that character again.
Yeah.
I don't think she's thinking like, well, what project will that be in? What is the reality of this? You know, I think it's just more of kind of like a pie in the sky. Yeah, that would be fun.
Okay.
I'm just curious, is there any episode to you that sort of stands out is like the ultimate sort of representation of 7 of 9 on screen? Like, for me, I always think of Someone to Watch Over Me. That's the one that really comes back to me, is like, I think my favorite 7 of 9 story.
Okay, that's interesting. I always think of that as a Doctor episode, and it's perhaps, I'd put that in my top 5 Voyager, maybe even top 3 fact, you know. But for a 7 episode, one that might not get much a notice because I think it was a pretty lame season finale was Hope and Fear.
Yeah.
I think that's a great 7 story right there, where, of course, a prototype starship, a Starfleet starship, appears in the Delta Quadrant. It's going to whisk people back to the Alpha Quadrant, and 7 of 9 doesn't really know what to do. Does she want to go back to this? And then we find out that it's actually not a Starfleet starship at all.
Right.
But I think that's a great journey for 7 to go on. I think Hope and Fear is one overlooked, but it's worth reviewing again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Cam, we've got so many to go through at this point. Let's jump into Data, because Data, we couldn't help but bring him up in our previous conversation about 7 of 9. Data, we're introduced to him. He's so obviously this Pinocchio figure where all
he
wants...
What are you talking about? I never picked up on that.
But all he wants to be is a real boy. And I think he has to be up there with Spock as, you know, the two most popular outsider characters that Star Trek produced.
Who do you think is more popular within... If you talk to the average fan nowadays, who do you think they're going to say?
I still think Spock gets it.
You think Spock still gets it?
And I think a lot of it has to do with Leonard Nimoy's legacy. Yeah. You know,
I feel like there was a point, though, where Data would have been the go-to.
Yeah, you know, I would say year 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Spock's not coming back for Star Trek Generations. Data's getting his emotion ship.
Right.
You know, everybody's sold on him. But this is a character that I find him intriguing, and it's cliche at this point to say, like, wow, Brent Spiner, how do you play somebody with no emotions so well? It's kind of like, every time Brent Spiner got to stretch his wings on that show, you're always blown away by what a great actor he is. So
Masks.
One of your favorites. Yes. But look, a character like this, and we get to see, here's the thing, the HBO series Westworld, one of the big complaints is, you know, is an artificial life form, you know, really just like you and I? And a lot of the people reviewing it are like, I don't care. Like, I just don't care about this journey about artificial intelligence and stuff.
Right.
But the way Brent Spiner plays Data and the way that they write Data, to me, I'm far more invested in his journey than I am with a lot of these hosts from Westworld right now.
What about the robot in Ex Machina?
Oh, to me, I had that kind of reaction. It's just like, I don't really think she's... I'm not invested in her.
Really? I see. I very much was.
Okay.
Yeah.
To me, it's just I've got this thing in my head where it's just like, well, it's just it's,
like they're not people. I don't care.
Yeah. You know, but look, I love that conversation that Beverly had with Data when he was just asking her to define life, and she gives off all these little traits, and he's just like, well, wouldn't you say the same thing about fire?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And she's like, well, no, you have sentience, Data, and. You know, but I mean, one of the killers for me here, not killer, but like one of the killer episodes is The Offspring, where Data has his daughter. Cam, I've been going on and on about what a great journey Data goes on. But what are your thoughts, especially as you came into Next Gen, you know, more of a casual fan, and then you got to review the series or rewatch the series from start to finish. What did you think about Data's journey?
Yeah, I agree. Like, Data is a really fantastic representation of this type of character. What makes, I think, Data so effective is how durable he is. He's a character who can be put in any scenario, and because he has a sort of like childlike wonder looking at the world, he's always going to have an interesting perspective on what's going on. This is not the case for a lot of these characters we're going to talk about. Like, yeah. You're not going to kind of have Seven of Nine doing comedy with Joe Piscopo. Although I would love to see that.
Yeah. No, you're going to get her singing cabaret songs on the holodeck during the Killing Game.
Or you're not going to have T'Pol, like, doing tap dancing with, you know, Crusher. Whereas, like, Data, you can put him in ridiculous situations, and you can put him in very serious situations, and it always works. Like, that character is just so flexible for storytelling, and a lot of it is because he is very childlike. He's instantly adaptable to scenarios in ways that these kind of more rigid characters aren't. He's always open to new experiences.
Very childlike, but ultra competent, and I think that, you know, people always feel
and curious.
Safe. Yeah. Yeah, you know, but I like how people feel secure when Data's around, though, even if they have to maybe explain some nuances. Him and Wesley commiserating over the Sadie Hawkins dance and what a ordeal that is, you know? Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'm still surprised that they'd have a Sadie Hawkins dance in the 24th century, though.
Do we even have them now?
There was, when I was in junior high, we had some dances. It wasn't called Sadie Hawkins, but it was where like the girls were supposed to ask the boys.
And how did you go?
I didn't go.
Oh man, that couldn't have been a better answer.
Thanks, Cam.
Anyway, you were the Jordy LaForge of the high school.
I went with my hologram. I brought a Leah Brahms action figure with me,
a custom one because there wasn't one made.
Yeah. Well,
getting back to Data, let's leave that anyway. Those childhood wounds behind.
Yeah. Okay, you bring up something here. Like, you know, he's kind of seen as this child, and I bring up the fact, but he's ultra competent. Mm. I think this is a great example in Unification Part 2, where he is put in command of a ship, the USS Sutherland. Was it the USS Sutherland?
Yes.
Okay. And the first officer.
That's in Redemption. Redemption Part 2, I believe.
I apologize. I knew it was a two-parter.
Unification, remember, they're searching for embedded Romulans.
They're embedded, Cam.
They're embedded.
There's going to be 3,000 of them capable of taking over an entire planet.
With pea shooters, yeah.
Because they're embedded.
Yeah.
Anyway, Redemption Part 2.
Right.
Great episode because, of course, the first officer is just like, hey, nothing against you. I don't think androids would make good captains. Just like I don't think a Klingon would make a good ship's counselor. You know?
Right.
And then it was really amazing, like, watching Data kind of kick some ass as a captain, though.
Well, it's interesting because Spock had an episode where he was in charge in Galileo 7 in the original series. We'll talk more about that later. But with Spock, they made much more of a point of the crew really not trusting him, and Spock not being very good at being in charge.
Yeah.
Not till kind of later in the series. Whereas Data is instantly ultra-competent. It's more about the people around him being insecure about an android being in charge, which I always thought was an interesting tack to take.
But it's interesting, okay, you have outsiders. Okay, we're talking about the episode Outsiders, but outsiders to the Enterprise come aboard, and they're always the ones that are far more wary of Data and his competence and whether or not he has an understanding of humanity than anyone in the main crew.
Mm-hmm.
Just think about an episode like In Theory when he starts dating a woman. And I think the one folly of this episode is, like, you're dating a woman who has clearly bad taste in men.
What are you talking about?
Okay. But it's like, well, I'm just wondering if Data has sat back and questioned the fact, why is this woman dating me when she clearly doesn't know what she's doing in the first place either?
That episode is one of those conceits where I'm just like, I'll go with it, go because with it. There's a great story to be told, and I do think it's a really good episode.
It is, yeah.
Patrick Stewart directed that, didn't he?
I think it was his first
one. I think you're right.
Yeah.
And I know he holds it up very high in sort of his, in regard for the episodes he directed.
Another one Patrick Stewart directed was Hero Worship, in which Data saves that boy who starts imitating him.
Another great episode. It's all the hits. The Fistful of Datas. Oh, man, we're on a roll.
I don't know if Hero Worship is a great episode.
Great episode. Great episode. But no, you know, that relationship episode is, I think, very touching, and we learn a lot about the character of Data. But it is one of those situations where you think of the real life variation on this, and it's like, I don't know that this situation would happen.
Yeah.
I just don't think so.
Maybe let's flash forward.
Maybe I'm just jealous because Data gets dates better than I do.
He actually went to the Sadie Hawkins dance.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, it is necessary to have those stories, because we had, obviously, the seduction with Tasha Yar in The Naked Now early on. So I do like that they do explore Data's attempts at romance throughout the series. Like, it wasn't kind of like, if they just stopped after Naked Now, it would be like basically used as a punchline to a joke. And then never acknowledged again.
Yeah. Much like Jordy LaForge just turned into a punchline for a joke.
Exactly. Yeah.
If you go to Data during the movies, though, the movies are, look, it's an ensemble television series.
Yeah.
But the films are, it's the Picard and Data show through and through. You know, and so we get him with the emotion chip, which I don't think quite, that's a very busy movie, and I don't know if Data with an emotion chip quite works.
Well, I think Data, of all of the characters we're going to talk about in this episode, is the one who runs the biggest risk to being grating. And I can't think of many times where, you know, Spock or Odo are annoying me. Whereas there are definite points throughout the series where Data can be a little bit annoying.
If the Doctor from Voyager still made it onto our list of outsiders,
right?
I would definitely put him on that list.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
As soon as he gets that holographic camera, and it's like, oh god. But I think they find a better balance when we get to Star Trek First Contact, where he turns the emotion chip off and then the Borg Queen starts tapping into it. Which I think is a very fascinating kind of story there. But then you go to Insurrection.
He plays in Hay.
If we're discussing the journey of these outsider characters, Cam, I don't know if 1 2-hour period of time did more damage to Data's character than this, where we essentially see him revert back to like his pre-season one form.
It felt to me like Data's story arc ended with First Contact. Yes, there's an epilogue at the end of Nemesis to it all, but it does feel like after First Contact, they're kind of just spinning their wheels with Data.
Yeah. I mean, they try to do something in Nemesis, and I think it utterly falls flat with the introduction of B4,
right?
Getting Data's memories and singing songs at the end, and obviously the destruction / termination / death of Data. That was such a bad call, and not because I don't think they could have given him a good, you know, death, but it's that death was pretty lame.
Do you think that death was the best solution to the Data character? Because, you know, when Spock killed himself, saving the crew in Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, it felt like a logical endpoint to that character, that he would sacrifice himself for his friends, which is something that, you know, just being a Vulcan and struggling between sort of his Vulcan and human side, it meant something. Did it, like, mean something for the character of Data, though, to kill himself for the crew in the end?
Well, so there's two different things going on. It's like, did it mean anything in the way that it was executed on screen? And I think
I think we know that didn't.
Yeah, we know that didn't work.
I mean, thematically to the
thematically,
character.
I would say no, because I think the much better end to the character is what we saw in All Good Things, where you see this guy still experimenting with humanity. He's getting like a skunk spots, you know, he's hanging out at Cambridge, you know, he's still having that journey that goes on in perpetuity. I like the idea that and Data had this discussion, I'm blanking on the episode name, season four or season five, where he's talking about, maybe it was Time's Arrow, where he was talking about, like, his own mortality, because I believe it's when he finds his head.
Right.
And he was talking about the idea, like, well, he knew he would make friends in generations, and then they would die off, and he'd continue on and make new friends, and so on and so on. I see, like, Data almost like Highlander.
I was thinking Bicentennial Man.
Okay. But, you know, he would just keep going on in his journey. Like, his journey is something that, like, essentially Data...
He'd be like the kid in AI. He'd be, like, visiting the Blue Fairy.
That's another AI entity that I didn't really care for.
I need to revisit that movie because people tell me how great it is, and I just remember seeing it in theaters and not enjoying it.
I revisited it, I would say, maybe 2009, and I just, no.
No,
still. Honestly, I've seen that movie three times. I saw it twice in theaters.
I
don't
just
ask
saw
me
it once. Was it with a date?
No. I'm still waiting for that Sadie Hawkins dance invite. Yeah. Oh, well. But thematically, I don't think it works for Data.
No, to me, it feels like it was only done because of Wrath of Khan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't, you know, the Spock endpoint there makes sense for that character. Whereas with Data, I don't think there was ever a question in my mind throughout the entirety of the series that Data would do this for the crew.
Yeah.
Like, that would be his automatic go-to.
Absolutely.
I feel like.
Yes.
So it was kind of like, well, yeah, I guess. It's, you know, it doesn't really feel that much different than, like, Trip killing himself, like, randomly. Because the thing is, when Spock does it, it's a moment that feels like this is something that weighs heavily on this character and is a major turning point in his sort of continued evolution as a character. With Data, yeah. This could have happened in season four to save the crew. Like, it doesn't feel like something that he would sit there and
contemplate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it just kind of feels like tossed off, and you're like, well, okay.
Okay. So, Cam, if we're talking about characters that by the end have a better grasp of humanity, who'd you rank higher, Seven or Data, by the end of their journey?
I would say Data.
Okay.
Because Data also gets into a lot of things like art, music, personal expression in a way that I think is...
Childbearing. Or child rearing.
Like, childbearing? What
child episode? Rearing, I meant to say. Yeah.
That would be an amazing episode. Be like the Data in Junior 2.
Junior.
It's not a tumor.
But, I mean, so much of Data feels like tapping into the things that make humans what they are.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think Seven really gets as much of that. Like, she's just not as open to it.
Yeah.
Data is really pursuing the things that make him human. The only thing that doesn't make Data human is, you know, that he's not flesh and blood.
And I think that's the key difference between them is Data is actively seeking out humanity.
Yeah.
You know, Seven of Nine is somebody who's struggling with it, like how much she actually wants it to happen to her, this exploration, you know. So I would say by the end of their journeys, you know, televised / filmed journeys, mm-hmm. I would say Data has a better grasp on humanity here. Cam, jumping forward, Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
We do have Odo here, because this is a television series populated by pretty much nothing but outsider characters, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. But if we have to have, like, pick one that's the one who's there to comment on humanity, and a lot of times what he doesn't necessarily like about humanity,
right.
But I would say Odo is the one, but I think he's different than a lot of the other characters that we're talking about, because I don't think he's necessarily striving to become human. It's more he's striving for some sort of place in society, and I think that's kind of another typical outsider experience that people have to deal with.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Odo, a lot of it too feels very much fueled by resentment, insecurity,
yeah.
Anger, which is not something we see in, say, you know, Spock or Data.
And look, he's somebody who wondered about his own heritage for a long time, and then he kind of discovered that they were, I guess, monsters to a certain degree.
Right.
And then he comes to embrace it, and just think about the damage that it does to probably the most important relationship that he has, and that's with Kira, who for a big chunk of season six did not trust Odo going forward.
Right.
Until his way.
Well, that's what I loved about Odo, is something that the other characters on this list didn't get, is that real shades of gray morality.
Yeah.
Because Odo is such an outsider, he has his own sort of moral code that can be very flexible depending on who he's working for, whether it's the Cardassians or the Federation or, you know, whoever's essentially ruling over Deep Space Nine.
Well, that's what I think is fascinating, though, is because even the Bajorans and the Cardassians, when it was Tarek Nor, they recognized him as an outsider.
Yeah.
And so they're like, well, you can be in charge of kind of the quote-unquote justice system here.
Right.
And so, and the fact that we have kind of this revolving door of authorities coming in, we have the Bajoran militia, which he ends up joining, they still see him as kind of this guy who can handle the justice side of things. He's still this outsider character, no matter who's kind of in charge.
Which is kind of what makes him great at his job, is that he's pretty incorruptible.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have allegiance to either side, really.
Could you ever imagine bribing Odo?
What would you bribe him
with? Well, exactly. I'm like, I don't know.
Maybe if you were like, I'll make Quark disappear. He might be like, yeah, I'm listening.
I think I think maybe somebody who came close or who could have come close was, do you recall Loss from the episode Chimera, played by J.G. Hertzler? He was the other infant changeling right. that they discovered, capable of traveling at warp speed. These changelings can do anything.
They're pretty amazing.
Yeah, okay. But I think it's always interesting when you see Odo interacting with, say, the female changeling, or else interacting with a character like Loss.
Right.
And how his allegiance to Starfleet is so tenuous, mm-hmm. which is surprising to us, because we think of characters like Data or Spock, and they're for the uniform. So it's hard for us to see a guy like Odo, and it's like who's his allegiance to, really, though?
It's really to his people, but he's also opposed to what his people are doing.
Yeah,
all Odo really wants is to belong.
And you hit it when you said that he's not really corruptible.
Yes,
and I think that's a very important factor, though. Maybe like he's not like holding allegiance to the Starfleet uniform. He doesn't even wear one, but he is like somebody that you can trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's completely trustworthy, but. You know, we see with the founders that he's not willing to just join them in the Great Link because he doesn't agree with them. Like, he has to feel comfortable with the intentions of those he's aligning himself with to a certain degree. He has to feel safe. Odo is such a character who's got so much insecurity that he needs to feel safe. And I don't think he really finds that until the very, very end of Deep Space Nine when he joins the Great Link.
Yeah. But if we're talking about, like, these kind of journeys through humanity, Odo, his is a very different one, but he's going through a lot of the same beats that these other characters do, especially when he's dealing with, say, like romances. He eventually right. has that with Kira.
He also has the one with Arissa in A Simple Investigation.
Yeah. And it's interesting because he's actually in his solid state yeah. as opposed to the changeling state there. I think one of the most important episodes for me as I was going through Deep Space Nine early on was Necessary Evil, mm-hmm. where it's essentially flashing back and it shows that, you know, we're talking about how this kind of incorruptible nature that's associated with Odo. But then, of course, he's conducting that investigation and he lets, in a flashback, and he lets Kira essentially get off the hook yeah. For a very serious crime.
Yeah.
So it kind of ties back to, like, these feelings that he has for Kira.
Mm-hmm.
Which yeah. the actors did not really like that it went down the romantic path, though, but I thought it worked as a viewer.
I really liked it a lot. I think it added a lot to that character that, you know, Odo is someone who we just see is so uncomfortable all the time. And a lot of these characters we're talking about in this episode or in this episode of the podcast are people that wanted to kind of feel humanity, or they were drawn towards it. I don't think Odo ever wants to be a human.
No.
And when he is made of solid, he's miserable.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I think, you know, his connection with Kira is something that is very profound because of that. That's the lone bright spot to his entire experience in that life.
Maybe I'll pose this question and we can discuss this. Why are we talking about Odo as the outsider character, not, say, Quark?
Oh, I don't think Quark's an outsider.
Yeah.
Quark knows the score. You know, he's got his hands in all the pies. He's someone who's very much enmeshed in the society around him, whereas Odo is not.
But I'd say he's outsider in that. He would never get to go grab beers with Ben at any point.
Sure.
You know, what I think he does, though, have possessed that Odo does not is just a stronger grasp on how humanity operates.
Right.
You know, I think another...
I think Quark understands people far better than Odo ever will.
Yeah.
I mean, there. You know, Quark has that big speech about root beer at the end of, you know, an episode where he's comparing the Federation to root beer. He understands everything that's going on around him far better than I think Odo does. Odo is very naive.
Yeah, absolutely. But this kind of brings me into my next point here, though. When we see Odo, like an older Odo in Children of Time, this, of course, is the episode where we get to see an alternate crew of the Defiant that crash land on this planet, and generations upon generations populate this planet. Mm-hmm. We see a much older Odo. Tell me that's not a guy who's far more at ease with himself than the Odo that we know so well.
I mean, it couldn't. It's not too hard.
Yeah,
because he's pretty miserable for the the duration of the 7 years we saw him.
But it was actually that version of Odo that it took for him to go and say to Kira, like the older version of Odo is like, "Hey, look, I have feelings for you, and my past self would never bring myself to admit that to you. But I'm telling you, as an older person, that's my biggest regret." And I think that's, to me, that was one of my favorite Odo moments ever, even though it was kind of like an alternate Odo.
I mean, I love the episode His Way, which is the one where he finally opens himself up to Kira, and the romance kind of starts from there, because it's just seeing this character who, I mean, what would you say for the first, you know, five-ish seasons or whatever Odo wanted?
And that's such a big, important question to ask.
Because he feels rudderless, you know, in a lot of ways. Like, he's kind of doing this job that's kind of all he has, and it doesn't seem like he really has clear objectives of things he wants.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the imperative things that you want when you're, you know, constructing a drama. Like, what is a character's motivation? And I think the best...
We know what Quark wants in episode to episode.
The best you could say for Odo is that he wants peace and order.
Sure.
For all those Canadian listeners out there, it's we don't pursue life and liberty. It's peace, order, and good government. That's actually what the founders of, or the fathers of Confederation set out to do. And I think it's interesting that, look, Odo, very much a peace and order kind of guy. So are the founders, though. I think that's ingrained in him. And like, he wants people to fall in line with a certain thing. But on a personal level, what is he seeking out? I'll say this. I think he wants answers about his own heritage.
Yes.
And when he gets them...
He's like, I'm going back to Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. So, okay, so Cam, out of the characters we discussed so far, Data, Seven, Odo, where would you place Odo on the spectrum of having a strong grasp of humanity by the end of the journey?
I would put him at the bottom.
At the bottom, okay.
I think so. I do, because I don't feel like Odo's journey is about connecting to humanity that much.
No. I agree.
I mean, at the end of his sort of appearances in the What We Leave Behind, it's him and Kira saying goodbye. He's not, you know, hugging the whole crew goodbye. Like, where was the big scene of his farewell to, you know, Bashir?
Yeah, or giving O'Brien a big bear hug.
Yeah, exactly. Like, his journey was about finding some place to belong.
Yeah.
And he found it with Kira, and he found it with the Great Link, ultimately.
Yeah.
It wasn't about connecting to the glory that is humanity.
Hey, Jake, let's fist bump before I go, man.
Word to your mom.
Wow. Jennifer Sisko? Dead Jennifer Sisko?
Dark.
Wow, Cam. Okay. Awkward. You say that I would still place Odo, when it comes to understanding humanity, I found that his relationship with Kira was far more authentic than the Chakotay 7 relationship.
I don't know what you're talking about. When they were cooking together, oh man.
Oh yeah.
I was getting the vapors.
When she was transporting into his quarters to mac on him, yeah.
When we do Star Trek's most uncomfortable moments, that's going to be on the list.
Yes. I would place Odo below Data for sure, but above 7 myself. Okay. So, okay, Cam, next character here.
Yes, we're going to get to T'Pol.
We've got a Vulcan, but it's not the one you're probably hoping for. We're going to save Spock for last. But T'Pol, this is a character that I really struggled with when I was watching Enterprise at the time. Seasons 1 and 2, I watched diligently, and then I kind of gave up by the time we got to Season 3.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do recall watching, I think, like the premiere episode for it. I had already kind of given up on Enterprise, but anyway, sorry. I'm repeating myself. Everybody knows this. But what I'm getting at, though, is T'Pol is a character that I just really had a tough time wrapping my head around. And I was complaining to you after you convinced me to go back and watch season three and four, which to this day, I think season four of Enterprise is one of the best seasons, period, of Star Trek. But I was struggling with T'Pol so much because I was just like, why is this the most emotional Vulcan in the world? You know, and it also bothered me because, like, oh man, it has to be a woman character who's a Vulcan, and she has to be the one who's always getting emotional. And it's just like, this is not really doing feminism any favors here.
There's also the issue that, especially in the first couple seasons, they didn't quite know how to write Vulcans very well. Like, that's something that a lot of the other series didn't do. The original series is, like, brilliant at it.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the series going forward was like, let's just write them as, like, dicks. Yeah. You know, they're just, like, uptight kind of jerks.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, a real mistake. Because Vulcans, when they're written well, can be really charismatic and entertaining characters. Like, they're interesting to watch. And T'Pol, for the first couple seasons, they basically write her like an ice queen completely. And a lot of the show becomes Archer and Trip being like, lighten up. You know, like, boy, are you stuck up. And it's like, you know, this isn't really the most respectful way to tackle a character, you know. And the writers don't do her any favors because they're writing T'Pol as a character that no viewer is like, I really like this character.
Yeah, well, why would a character want to get behind T'Pol just based on what the writers are giving her?
Yeah, because when you look at Spock, who was the most popular character of the original series when it's on the air, you know, the one who's getting the most fan mail, Spock is really magnetic and fascinating to watch, and he's fun.
Yeah.
What is fun about T'Pol in the first couple seasons of Enterprise?
I'm a vegetarian. You humans smell funny.
I hate movie night.
Yeah.
It's just a personality that you don't really want to spend that much time with. And it's really too bad because I think Jolene Blaylock is really good in the role. And when they give her good material, yes, and they do, T'Pol becomes, I think, a fascinating character who's really deserving of a lot of credit.
Well, let's flash forward to, say, season three, because
there's glimmers early on, because I think, like, Carbon Creek in season two, while not T'Pol, is a female Vulcan story that is, I think, really compelling.
Okay, but I've got to dismiss Carbon Creek because that's so not a T'Pol episode at all.
Like, no.
As great an episode as it is, and I like it, I can't give her brownie points for a character growth because of Carbon Creek.
What about sort of the fact that she's sort of joking at the end, though?
Like, about her age?
No, about the fact, you know, they're like, was that story true? And she's kind of smirking about it. Like, she's showing a playful side. Like, that's something we don't see enough of, I think, early on with T'Pol, is that Vulcans can be playful.
Sure.
And I do like that the show went there.
2 seconds of playfulness, literally 2 seconds of playfulness, not enough. The reason I want to say skip ahead to season three is because I think they started to get a better grasp on her.
Neuro pressure.
Yeah. Those massages, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously. Let's be honest. Another thing that kind of irked me is like, you've got this Ice Queen character whose job it is to just like take her clothes off and get decon gelled up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just like, oh, great, guys. This is, by the time we got to that season four Vulcan arc where they're addressing why the Vulcans aren't really written consistently, you know, the fact that the Vulcans that we know in Enterprise act very differently from the ones that we know from the rest of Star Trek, and they actually address the reasons why. I actually really came to like T'Pol legit as a character. I'm just like, and just all the stuff going on with her husband and her own torment about like actually wanting to pursue a relationship with Trip. To me, you're giving this character, it's just been like 3.5 short years on the NX-01, but you can see that humanity is rubbing off on her in a big way.
Yeah, and you know, when we have that episode, the Terra Prime Demons two-parter, where, you know, she finds out that, you know, she has incompatible DNA with Trip, so they'll never be able to have children, and then there's the clone. That has, like, shattering emotional depth to it that brings so much to that character. Like, you know, Spock, Data, what have you, Odo, great characters we love. They had 7 pretty great seasons to themselves, plus movies in certain cases. Yeah. T'Pol, they had about 2 seasons, maybe, you know? And you look at the handling, because a lot of, I think, what moves me the most about T'Pol isn't so much the relationship with Trip, it's with Archer. Now, early on, we're seeing episodes like A Night in Sick Bay, which is about how Archer can't stop having fever dreams about the sexiness that is T'Pol.
Get out of my head, Cam.
You know, I mean, like, that is not to me particularly interesting. What does become interesting is, like, in season three, you have that episode Twilight, which is sort of this, you know, Archer kind of unstuck in time, essentially.
Okay.
And we see the future where we get a glimpse of what could be an alternate future of, like, T'Pol looking after Archer. Like, I really appreciate the loyalty they show between these characters and how T'Pol really does care for him in a way that I don't think is communicated. It's never feels like the show is really hammering that on the audience. Like, it's there. And we see it, you know, at the end, the final disastrous episode, and these are the voyages, you know, when he's going to give his speech. Like, you can feel the closeness between Archer and T'Pol in a way that I really like a lot. And I think it shows a lot about in the growth of T'Pol that this relationship doesn't feel, you know, getting back to Chakotay and Seven of Nine, that feels thrown together at the end to give some sort of weird endpoint to T'Pol or to Seven of Nine.
Yeah.
Whereas the gradual sort of evolution of the Archer and T'Pol working relationship and interpersonal relationship, I think, is something that slowly develops. It's not delivered in big, flashy moments, but it's there at the end.
But and this is one of the tropes in television that I always kind of irks me, is though, like, if you have a male and a female that have a great platonic relationship, the writers are always like, we should make them get romantic.
Right.
And that always kind of bugs me. I don't think they were ever planning on going down that route with Archer and T'Pol.
You don't think they were maybe flirting with the idea around the time of A Night at Sickbay?
I don't think it would have worked, though, because I think the writers knew, maybe can, like, tease that idea. I don't think they were ever honestly going to really pursue that.
I think they were leaving that door open. They weren't going to commit to it, but I think they were considering it.
Well, look how reluctant the writers were to get Troy and Riker together.
Right.
Beverly and Picard.
Right.
You know, or think about Chakotay and Seven. That took 4 seasons. No, you know, I actually do remember at the time that the writers really weren't interested in getting Paris and B'Elanna together, but I think there's just so much fan campaigning for it.
I think that was actually better that they did get together. I think that actually worked really well.
Paris and B'Elanna?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm down with that. But I would not have wanted to see Archer and T'Pol as Knight.
No, I like the fact that they're these very kind of warm friends at the end, which kind of mirrors the Spock-Kirk relationship, which obviously was the foundation for the T'Pol-Archer relationship in the start.
Yeah. Cam, where does T'Pol rank on... does she have a better grasp of humanity in your book versus, say, Odo or Seven of Nine?
I think better than Odo and Seven of Nine. Okay. I would put her under...
Under Data.
Yeah.
So it'd go Data, then T'Pol, then Seven, then Odo.
Yeah.
Okay. I would put her above Seven, but would she go above Odo in my estimation? I actually think I would have to put her above Odo.
I think so.
I would have it Data, then T'Pol, then Odo, then Seven.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, sir. It's the big kahuna.
Right.
It's one Lieutenant Commander Spock, essentially. Commander Spock.
Right,
you know,
yes.
A first officer.
So much to say.
Yep.
I mean, this is the classic. This is the one that set the template for all of these characters we've talked about in this, you know, hour of podcasting.
Obviously.
You do not get there without Spock. And I think what makes Spock the most interesting, I think, of all of these is the fact that, unlike everyone else we've really talked about who are sort of major outsiders, Spock is half and half. He's half human, half Vulcan. So the connection to humanity is always there. And what I love about Spock is that he has embraced his Vulcan side for the most part. And so we secretly want him to feel the human connection between, you know, his, you know, Kirk and McCoy and all that. Like, we want to see Spock have fun. But we're also, because he's so well written as a Vulcan character, we don't want to see him give that up. We want him to be the Spock we know and love. So the viewer themselves are torn in this position of, like, we love Spock for who he is, but we're also like, oh man, can he be more human? But then he's not the Vulcan we know and love. Like, it's this really, you know, when we see Seven of Nine, we're not thinking to ourselves like, I hope she stays a Borg.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Odo, like, I hope he's a grouch. You know, like, whereas Spock, we're always kind of pulling for the human side, but we also love him as a Vulcan.
Yeah, and I think it's that internal torment that he has as well, as this half-human. He doesn't want to be human either. And I think that's an interesting parallel between him and Seven of Nine, and a big difference between him and Data, which I think was very smart on the part of the writers when they launched TNG. Like, you want this android to want to be human as this outsider character versus Spock, who, I'll tell you my own personal journey with Spock. Like, the Spock that I knew and grew up with was a Spock from the films. Like, I had not first been introduced to him through the television series.
I'm just glad you didn't say my was Unification.
Yeah, wow. Was he even in...
well, part two.
Yeah. But which is actually a fairly different Spock as I'm discovering as I go through the original series, but a fairly different, you know, Vulcan character than what I think people had been used to. And I think you actually helped me out with that. I think you had pinpointed that it has a lot to do with that ritual that he went through in Star Trek The Motion Picture, where all of his emotions were completely purged.
Yeah, it's a real credit to the writers that Spock's journey, I think, feels like it's going, like they always have some place to take it. I think at least until you get up until Star Trek 3 when they bring him back. I think 3 until 6, they're kind of resetting him back to kind of where he was around maybe Star Trek 2.
But it's still an interesting journey that he goes on in Star Trek 4, I would say. Like
into the whale tank?
Yeah. Yeah. Wet t-shirt contest at the end.
I don't know. I mean, him just saying that he feels fine. I mean, that's...
But you don't think it's interesting, though?
Is it interesting? It's
a different...
It doesn't feel particularly rich or substantial coming after the arcs of The Motion Picture and Wrath of Khan.
Well, I don't know if the motion picture... Well, okay, you know, I do take that back. I guess the parallels between V'ger and Spock are interesting, you know. Okay, well.
But, I mean, what I love about the original series, too, was that we got episodes, usually by DC Fontana, that really tapped into Spock as his human side and what it could mean, what his, you know... future could be. I think of the episode This Side of Paradise, where are these alien spores infect much of the crew and kind of makes them feel like they're on drugs, essentially, like they're all kind of hallucinating or having a great old time. But for Spock, it actually taps into his human side, and he becomes basically fully human and has a love affair with an old girlfriend named Layla, and we get to see Spock carefree, having fun, emotionally connected to this young woman, and ultimately, he chooses, you know, in the end, he's going back to his Vulcan side, but he implies to her that, you know, he knows it's his own personal purgatory, is that he can't connect with the people he necessarily wants to connect because he is a Vulcan.
It's his own personal purgatory, but he would prefer life that way.
Yes. It's like he's aware of what he's giving up, but it's kind of like the greater goal. It's like it means so much more to him to be a Vulcan, but he also... is very respectful to the sacrifices he's making in that path.
Yeah. Speaking of that path, you brought up, I think, a very important episode earlier, Galileo 7, where he is trying to function as a commander on this crash landing on a planet, and they're trying to get off the planet, and he struggles quite a bit. I think as logical as he wants to be, and let's talk about his whole logic dilemma here. As logical as he wants to be, that doesn't necessarily always make for the best command skills at this point, because of course, you know, crew members are dying. People are like, look, we need to have like some sort of service for him. He's like, no, I'm busy with other things.
Yes.
You handle it.
He's like yelling at the crew the whole episode. Yeah.
So his journey... Do you think Spock, if he had embraced his human side instead of his Vulcan side, do you think he would have been naturally a better commander at that point in his journey? Just at that point in his journey.
I think he would have had a better understanding of personalities, which would have helped maybe with command. But I don't know, because I feel like later on when Spock is in command positions, he's very good at his job.
Yeah.
It's just, it was sort of like the learning curve. Like what I think is great about Spock is that he does learn from his mistakes. He's very observant. And so we see in Galileo 7, like, he knows that things aren't going well. I don't think he left that mission going like, well, I'll replicate that experience again next time that happens.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like he is always someone who's learning, and he's, you know, like Data, he's also very driven to improve himself.
Yeah.
Which is something that, you know, maybe like Odo's not, or Seven of Nine necessarily isn't.
How about, okay, because a lot of these characters, we're trying to determine how much they are trying to come to a better understanding of humanity. Does Spock care?
I don't think he has to care, because he already knows to a certain degree, because his mother, Amanda, you know, she's human. He's aware of what humans, you know, are. And he's, you know, best friends with Kirk. And, you know, he hangs out with McCoy. So he knows exactly, you know, I don't think he's sitting there saying, boy, I wish I was like Kirk. I think he's intrigued and fascinated by humans. I think he likes the company of them.
He is a science officer, if only from kind of the task of an observer. He likes seeing how things operate in these sorts of situations. What do you think, though, of this? What if I pose this to you? How far does Kirk come? We keep talking about people trying to discover or have a better grasp of humanity. How does Kirk's grasp of Vulcans end by you know, the end of his time on Star Trek? Does he have an equal grasp of Vulcans as Spock would have of humans?
I would say no.
Yeah.
No, I think Kirk is far more caring about the individual that is Spock than the Vulcan people. Like, Spock is someone to me who likes being around humans because he likes being challenged. I think Spock likes the logical exercises of being surrounded by illogical, you know, creatures that kind of poke and, you know, prod him to basically kind of always hold that side of a little bit loftier stature. Like,
sure.
I think Spock likes sitting up on a little bit of a perch and having to challenge that and own it, you know? Like, he's not someone who wants to just be handed a position. He wants to kind of prove that he is really good at what he does.
Do you think he's smug to a certain degree?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think lovably so. Like, I don't think Spock is someone who's...
Do you think he
feels negatively towards others?
But do you think there's somewhat self-aware that he is antagonizing
people? I think definitely yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there are moments throughout, especially the movies, where that is not shown to be the case. Like Star Trek IV, when he's in the car with Dr. Gillian Taylor and Kirk.
You can just call her Gillian.
You know, I don't think in that situation that he's like that self-aware. In fact, he's kind of a little dim.
Absolutely.
We'll blame the rebirth stuff on that, I guess.
I blame the LDS.
Sure, yeah. But I mean, you know, one of my favorite Spock episodes, it's one we really have to mention if we're going to talk about Spock, is Amok Time, which is the episode where he experiences Ponfar. And we have these amazing moments where he's talking to Kirk about what he's going through, and he's very reluctant to kind of open up, kind of like how Odo actually is. We have that episode where Odo and Loxanne are trapped on the turbo lift.
Yeah.
And he's dissolving. We see throughout the especially the early episodes or early seasons that Odo is terrified to kind of reveal his otherness to solids, essentially. And with Spock, we see that he's very nervous about letting, you know, humans aware of kind of what he's going through as a Vulcan. There's like an embarrassment factor to it. That episode is all about him making a connection with Kirk as a human and letting him in, essentially. And of course we have the big, you know, fight between the two, and, you know, the wedding, the aborted wedding and everything. But, you know, that episode of course ends with him thinking Kirk is dead and then finding out he isn't and breaking into that big smile and saying, Jim, you know. So the human side is always there with Spock, and I think the human side is part of the reason that he loves Kirk as much as he does. Like, I think while he represses his emotions, I think he's also in touch with the fact that he very much is, you know, he very much loves his friends.
Yeah. So overall, I mean, who do you think out of all these characters we've discussed has the strongest grasp of humanity here? Now we can do our final tally now that we've talked a little bit about Spock.
I mean, I think I would have to give Spock the most because he's also has the experience. Like Data, as much as Data will learn and study and the emotion ship stuff, he's never going to quite be all the way there, whereas Spock, you know, as we see in like This Side of Paradise or whatever, has been there.
I mean, I'll give top marks to Spock in this ranking here. I think I go Spock number one, which is interesting. Yeah, even though 7 of 9 is human, I have her on the bottom of my list here.
Yeah.
Well,
Well, I mean, what are you saying? You know, I want to say, though, as in regards to Spock, yes, yeah, you know, please. Where do you feel that Spock's brain ranks in his journey?
Yeah, that's something I was actually going to ask you. When it comes to discovering humanity.
Is that when he's discovering his inner android?
Inner caveman, perhaps, dealing with all the cavemen on the top, who are somehow able to procreate, I don't understand how, over centuries. There are only men at the top of the surface of that planet.
I'll have to get back to my fan fiction on that one. Okay. My sequel, The Spock's Brain.
Interesting dilemma.
Prequel. How we got there.
Thank you. Spock's membrane. Yeah. Okay. But I do dig the journey of Spock. I think out of all the characters, I think he has a better grasp of humanity. But of all the characters we've discussed, I'd still put Data as my favorite. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say you probably put Spock as your favorite.
Spock's my favorite, yeah. And now I'm curious. We've talked all these outsider characters who, not coincidentally, there's one in each series. Do you think we could ever see a Star Trek series without this character type?
No. And I do wonder who that kind of surrogate sort of is going to be in Star Trek Discovery. We've had Doug Jones cast. Yeah. And I do wonder, if you cast Doug Jones, are you casting him to be the outsider character?
And he is an alien.
Yeah.
An unknown alien type, too.
Yeah.
So, ..
Okay. I'm looking for... Hey, look, if Doug Jones is doing it, I'm looking forward to seeing what he brings to the table here.
And if we're going to see another outsider character in Discovery, I do hope it is an alien we haven't seen. Like, I think T'Pol, as much as I really, really like T'Pol, suffers just by being compared to Spock. You know, she'll always be second to Spock.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would love to see in Discovery an alien type, maybe one like, say, an Andorian or something that we've at least have awareness of, or a completely new species, just something that the journey that character goes through is going to feel different than all the ones we've talked about today.
Yeah, absolutely. Why isn't Tuvok even on this list, Cam?
Tuvok's not an outsider. I mean, he's pretty tight with the crew. Yeah. He's also... what is Tuvok's journey?
I don't know. I'm trying to think about it. It's like, if we had to do a list of top 10 Tuvok episodes, would we even get 10?
Well, it would be dead air for about 15 minutes while we tried to think of a single episode.
Yeah.
And then we would probably maybe name the one where he had Ponfar and then had the holodeck recreation with his wife.
Yeah.
And then we would just slowly peter out and it would just be, well, on that note.
Do you remember that episode where he and Neelix had to go up on a really high elevator?
Oh, that was the worst episode. I remember, it's all coming back to me. I remember watching that one and being bored senseless watching that episode. That was like... It's funny because on that DVD set, they have a bunch of hidden little bonus features where, you know, a crew member will talk about a specific episode and how much they like that episode. And there is a little bit, you know, 2-3 minutes talking about that episode. And I can't remember if it's Ethan Phillips or if it's Tim Russ or if it's both of them, where they're talking about how fantastic a team Neelix and Tuvok were and how much they loved doing those episodes. And how, you know, they wish there was more of them. I gotta say, I don't wish there was more of them.
How can we stop calling him Mr. Vulcan?
I don't know. To me, like, that they are a duo that just do not work.
But they really pushed for that duo, though.
Did you ever enjoy that duo?
No, I thought Neelix was just insufferable when he's like, hey, Mr. Vulcan.
Maybe we need to do an episode like worst character duos, worst character matches.
Yeah, well, we've got one already.
Yeah. Spoiler.
Okay.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of Star Trek's... well-known and classic outsiders. Which are your favorites? Which ones do you think... How would you rank them, actually? I want to know that. Our rankings between the two of us are pretty consistent, minus the bottom spots.
Yeah.
I'm curious if that's just the popular opinion, or...
Would any of you listeners, you know, include any of these outsider characters that we actually purposely excluded from our list here?
Purposely. Yeah. Right. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We are going to be having a fun episode. We are going to be digging into the most iconic moments in all of Star Trek. Cam, I'm looking forward to tackling this one next week.
I'm sure we can fit in all the iconic moments in one episode.
It'll be lickety-split, no problems. Yeah.
You can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vulcans make the best outsiders, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's REPORTONN as in Neelix and Tuvok team up. Gotta make it happen. I want that to be a Star Trek Discovery spinoff. Yeah.
So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.